Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Edmund White, whose latest novel is Jack Holmes and His Friend. Earlier books include Hotel de Dream, City Boy, My Lives, a Memoir, A Boy's Own Story. There are 25 books in all. Also brand new is a collection of essays called Sacred Monsters. But first, let's talk about Jack Holmes and His Friend, which is the story of a gay man and a straight friend through the 60s and 70s, primarily beginning in like the late 50s and ending with the advent of AIDS, except for an epilogue. I understand that you realized that nobody had been writing about friendships between straight and gay men, and you were going to tackle it first. Is that pretty much what happened?
Well, I love to do things first. Like, I wrote the first gay travel book, States of Desire, and I wrote the first gay sex guide, Joy of Gay Sex. And I wrote more or less the first gay coming out novel, The Boy's Own Story, now they're Legion. So I think that's fun when you can get to a subject before other people do. And people are always saying, oh, gay life, it's completely exhausted as subject matter. But I feel there are tons of things that nobody's talked about. And this was one of them, the friendship between a gay and straight man, which seems to me is a very common thing in urban life, but had never been tackled before, except maybe Michael Chabon had written about it.
The actual moment that you decided to write it, was there a specific trigger?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that it was sort of an idea I'd had for a while. I don't think there was a specific trigger. It just came time to write another novel, and it seemed to me it was a good subject.
In the novel, you go back to some of the terrain that you had just written about in City Boy. So there are parallels. When you were writing City Boy, were you also in the back of your mind thinking of what your next novel would be?
And No. I don't really think that far in advance. I'm sort of like a dray horse. We'll just put one foot in front of the next. I mean, now I'm writing a book about Paris in the 80s, and it's nonfiction. It's a memoir. And maybe after that I might write a novel about Paris. I don't know. People seem to like Paris as a subject matter.
When you're writing a book like City Boy, you're dredging up old memories. Did you take notes in those years?
No, it was all memories. It was all memories. I never kept a journal, and I didn't do any research for it. I just remembered things. And that's the same with this Paris book. Although now with Google, you can look everything up. I mean, in Paris, I was working as a journalist, and I interviewed a lot of filmmakers, and so I get curious about their other movies, and what year was that I saw Juliette Binoche and Rendezvous and things like that.
You now have access to going back, which you didn't have, but on the other hand, when you've dredged up these memories, it becomes, I don't want to say easier, but the memories are there, they're current when you're writing a book like Jack Holmes and His Friend.
Yes, although that's sort of part of my experience, the experience of Jack Holmes. I mean, what I tried to do in this book was to take more or less the trajectory of my own life and assign it to a character who was quite different from me. I went to the University of Michigan. I studied Chinese language, not Chinese art, but more or less the same thing. And I came to New York, and I worked for Time magazine. He works for something called the Northern Review, which is a bit like Horizon, which I worked for later. In other words, there are a lot of similarities, but there are a lot of differences, too. He's much better looking than I have any pretension to being. Doors open for him easily, partly because he's very well endowed, and so gay people are interested in him.
Why did you make that choice, to make him someone that everybody would be interested in, giving him those two prime characteristics?
I was interested in writing about a fairly passive character. He says at some point, I wanted to be an adjective, not a noun. I'm interested in writing about people who don't have much will or don't initiate things, but just sort of are spectators of life, partly because I'm so almost huffing and puffing, trying to make everything happen, and I've always been very aggressive, and I'm intrigued by people who are beautiful but passive.
But at the same time, I mean, I remember trying to write a novel at one point, and a friend of mine who's a writer made the comment, well, the problem with this is having a passive protagonist. Things happen to your character. Your character doesn't initiate. And without that, where are you?
Well, I think he was being unduly harsh. And I think you can take a passive character and make him or her. I wrote one novel that's never been published about a woman who is deeply passive in life, And I still think it's a good book. I would like to see it published someday.
What you don't do is actually just completely focus on Jack, because most of the book is about his friend Will, who is heterosexual and a lot more active in his choices. You've spoken before about how you chose to put Jack in the third person, though it's a close point of view character, and Will in the first. The reason you said is I wanted Jack to be mysterious, maybe because I wanted him to be sexy.
Yeah, I think that people are sexy only if they're slightly mysterious and you see them from a distance. Whereas I think it's very hard to fall in love with, they say no man's a hero to his valet. If you see somebody too intimately, it's hard to fall in love with them.
and so on some level, you wanted to kind of have your own crush on Jack.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of readers have told me they were in love with Jack, straight women and gay men.
Because of his looks, you set up an interesting dynamic that I've seen. Doors open for very good-looking people.
Yes.
And they just kind of accept that that's the way life is.
Yes, it's like very tall people tend to get well-paying jobs, and everybody wants to gravitate toward them at a party. And I'm sure they take it for granted, pretty much.
But that doesn't mean that they're narcissists or egotistical.
No, that's right. I mean, I don't think Jack is particularly narcissistic. But he is very promiscuous, and he's living through the 70s, which is the golden age of promiscuity. And he's very successful as a libertine, he calls it a libertine. And he even convinces his friend Will to become a heterosexual libertine. And so they're both libertines. He says, maybe we'll grow old this way, like two crocodiles in the mud. What they can't foresee is the advent of AIDS.
We've known a lot of Jacks. How about Wills? Have you met any people who were like him?
Yes. I used to work for Time magazine where everybody was called Auchincloss or something. And I teach at Princeton where there are a lot of blue bloods. And I guess I have known quite a few blue bloods in my life, maybe partly because I lived in Paris. And Will's a very particular kind that I have known examples of, people who are nouveau pauvre, but from a very distinguished family, who are Catholic, who are Southern. I mean, in other words, he has a lot of determinants in his life that make him fairly conservative, where you would expect him to be otherwise fairly progressive because he went to a good school and he's a novelist. And in the world of media in New York, you would think that he would be fairly progressive, but he's not. He's homophobic and probably a Republican.
I'm not sure if by the end of it he is, but you can't tell.
No, that's right. you can't tell.
Edmund White. As I was reading the book and reading a little bit about what you've said about the book, it occurred to me that on some level, you're playing actor here, attempting to inhabit these characters much as an actor would. Do you think that's a fairly good...
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I used to have my students read Stanislavski's An Actor Prepares, because even though they're writers, I thought that Stanislavski had lots of good hints about how to imagine your way into a character. So, like, for instance, let's say the character has something really catastrophic, like his child dies. Well, most actors have something like their cat died or whatever. I mean, some counterpart, so they can act on sense memory and find an equivalent to the character's experience. And I always think that way. I try to think, how would I feel in that situation? I spend a lot of time, especially with a book like this, which isn't any way a memoir, but has invented characters. I spend a lot of time on the couch, sort of daydreaming. It's what Flaubert called his marinade. I do a lot of marinade. I mean, it's one of the most creative parts of writing is just daydreaming.
When you're writing a character like Will, which is somebody very different from yourself, are you thinking of taking that person and putting him in certain scenes, or are you thinking of the scene first and then figuring out how he's going to respond?
I think mainly of the character, and I try to exploit his character by inventing scenes that will bring out different aspects of his life.
And in terms of the dynamic between him and Jack, at first Jack is in love with him, but over the course of their lives, they couldn't spend too much time together. They had to be off on their own.
Yes, that's true. I mean, partly Will's married and he lives in the suburbs and he has children and he has a lot of responsibilities. Jack is a man about town and the libertine, so their experience doesn't crisscross too much. In the 70s, when their friendship is renewed, they call each other a lot on the phone, which is a very New York thing. they say that that's where friendship really takes place in New York, is on the phone, because people never have time to get together. And the person you can tell is your really good friend is you can always break a date with him and not see him, and you end up seeing all the lesser important people in your life because you feel a sense of obligation, or that person holds you to your appointment. Whereas a friend will be very forgiving, and you end up not seeing him very much, but talking to him on the phone a lot. And they do talk to each other on the phone, and they have an agreement that if the other one's about to go into a meeting or has some crucial thing in his life, that they'll just hang up without explaining.
Did that happen to you?
It has, yeah, with other kinds of friends. I mean, my best friend was a guy who died of AIDS around 1985, David Calstone. He was a literary critic, and we would talk for hours and hours on the phone. And every tiny trivial thing in our life, like going to the dentist, was duly recorded and reported. I mean, we really lived on the phone. We'd cook while on the phone and tell each other recipes. And, of course, we gossiped all about our sex lives, but also about the people we'd seen the night before or whatever.
One thing I've noticed in reading books about the 60s, 70s, and 80s, or seeing movies, there were so many more ways to engage a plot because people were more out of touch than they are now. You know, and in terms of writing a book like this, the book would be very different if it took place now.
Yes, I think so, definitely. They wouldn't have so much to report to each other in a kind of condensed way. They could be in touch almost daily and say everything that way.
One thing that this brought up and City Boy brings up, because it is about gay life in the 70s, though we'll talk about the 60s in a minute, but let's confine ourselves to the 70s. To me, maybe I'm wrong, but if I look at the ages of gay life among people who are, say, over 60 now, we have pre-Stonewall, we have Stonewall, we have AIDS, and then we have the period, I would say, that started with Will and Grace leading up to gay marriage and where we are now.
Right. It's a very rapid trajectory, yeah, if you think about it. I don't know of any other minority group that's been on such a rapid spin cycle.
But the part of the spin cycle, the 13 or 14-year period, started with Stonewall in 69. I mean, almost immediately life changed.
That's right, absolutely.
Going up to 82 to 85, which is when AIDS
really hit.
That period, for a lot of men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, that's kind of a golden age.
Yes, it was, definitely. I mean, it wasn't pure pleasure, because I think a life of pleasure is always slightly melancholy. And everybody just took it for granted that you would walk down the street and pick somebody up and have two or three tricks a day. That was, in a way, ended by the back room, because people would be very haughty on the street. And then they knew they would finally get off in the back room. So that kind of dampened things. But in the early days, there was an awful lot of street cruising, and people perfected the art of how to do it, or pickups at bars.
During my 70s years, I had a lot of straight friends. I wouldn't really tell them what was going on. I mean,
they'd be horrified.
They'd be horrified. I remember being in a bathhouse once and thinking, if the Christian right knew about this, they'd kill us all.
Absolutely. And they were very happy when AIDS came along, and they saw it as God's punishment.
There's also in this book a little bit of straight women and gay men dynamic. What bothers me is there seems to be a tendency in fiction, on television, movies, and books, you know, the women are always Laura Linney, and the men are always Armstead Maupin, but that's not the case in real life.
No, that's true. Well, Jack has a crush on little old ladies. He's very attracted to them. I had a very beautiful Norwegian roommate once. I mean, he was a boyfriend, and he was a flight attendant. And he absolutely loved little old ladies, and he'd look absolutely entranced on the street sometimes. And he'd say, oh, isn't she cute? And everybody thought he was a total lunatic, but he really did think that. And so I gave that quality to Jack. I thought that was a funny thing.
Well, working on the relationship between him and Alexandra, who's pretty much his best friend until Will comes along, and then Will and Alex come together, what you don't delve into is when Alex and Will disappear into their old world, Jack has lost his two best friends.
That's true, and I think that does happen. I mean, Jack probably makes up for it with having lots of sex with random people. But there's not much continuity in that kind of life. Probably on some level, he misses his friends. But that does happen. I mean, straight people have a tendency to hive off and go into seclusion with their new mate when they couple.
Also, in the early part, back in the 60s, and this seems to be somewhat autobiographical, Jack is convinced he's sick.
Oh, yes. I mean, I wanted to show the different attitudes that gay men had toward themselves over a period of time. I mean, I really do believe that history, in this case a very rapidly changing history, influences the way we think about ourselves. So, like, I think that coming out of the very staid Eisenhower years of the 50s, Jack is somebody who goes to a psychiatrist and hopes to go straight, and who even tries to have sex with women and does more or less do it, and has very low self-esteem and doesn't want to have a lover. The truth is, when I came to New York, I think I didn't know any gay people who had lovers. I mean, a couple of boys from college, but they seemed kind of the exception to the rule. I think that most gay people, it was unusual to run into a couple. Now, I'm sure listeners listening to this would say, oh, no, I knew tons of them. But I didn't. It seemed quite rare, really, and I think it was because you didn't want to wake up in the morning with a lover who would be evidence that you really were gay. And it was better to have a blank slate every morning and to start off completely from zero and to think, well, maybe I might even end up straight today.
Well, what I saw was slightly different. All of the markings, the cultural markings for romantic relationships were men and women. There was no place to look for any kind of validation for any kind of gay relationship.
I know, and that's why I think certain books had an enormous impact on me. I think reading Nijinsky, The Life of Nijinsky by his wife, where she talks a lot about Nijinsky's relationship with Diaghilev, that was very important. And I think later in the 60s, reading A Single Man by Isherwood, that was an absolute turning point because, first of all, it treated the gay character as somebody who was well integrated into society and had lots of straight friends and who was a professor and not a hustler like most gay books until then, and who was madly in love with his lover who had died in a car crash. Anyway, all that seemed quite different from what had preceded it.
And that changed you in the way you view people, you think?
Well, I love that Isherwood book. I think it's a key book in the history of gay literature. Yeah, I think it was important because earlier gay books had always given the etiology of the character, like how did he come to be gay? That was a crucial question. And usually they would end in despair and suicide. But this book was very different. I mean, he does die at the end, but George, but it's kind of inadvertent. He has a heart attack or something. It's not really that he commits suicide. And you don't have any idea how he came to be gay, which I've never thought needed explaining any more than how people come to be straight does. They seem to me equally mysterious.
It seems also that over time, that has so transformed within our lifetimes so that now not only is the idea of a romantic relationship considered more commonplace, but because of gay marriage, it's become integrated into society.
Absolutely, an adoption. And I was on stage down at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles with a wonderful man. His last name is Roos, R-O-O-S, and he directed a movie called The Opposite of Sex. And anyway, he has a partner. They're married and they have children. He was on stage with me, and he kind of comically represented himself as the opposite of me. That is, somebody who was very square, he kept saying, and that he and his partner sit around watching TV all the time and worrying about the kids and driving them to their dancing lessons or whatever. That would have been unthinkable, that lifestyle, to most gays in the 60s and 70s.
Edmund White, in the past you said you were not an assimilationist. Has that changed?
Yeah, because I think that since the Christian right hates gay marriage so much and it's one of their major rallying cries, that therefore it's important to defend the institution of gay marriage. I mean, I'm opposed to marriage for anybody, including straight people. I don't think straight people should get married. But I can see why. I mean, I had a stroke in November. And I have a partner whom I've been with for 16 years and who's taken wonderful care of me since then. I don't know how people do these things on their own. He's just been invaluable, and I'm so grateful that I have him in my life. So I'm not opposed to long-term relationships or love or anything like that. I mean, it would be ludicrous to say you were opposed to it. And in the case of gay marriage, I think if the Christian right hates it so much, it can't be a bad thing.
Edmund White, you've also said, you said in a really good article that was in The Guardian not long ago, gay men handle friendships, particularly those with exes, much better than straight men. That's our family. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think straight people, the minute they get divorced, that's off of their heads, and they never want to see that person again, or maybe they have to if they're visiting rights with the children. But I also think that the governing metaphor in a male-male relationship is the best friend rather than the husband. I mean, with the best friend, you tend to esteem him and wish him the best. You want him to be happy, even if it means that he has an affair with somebody other than you. I think a lot of gay men, too, work together. They own an antique store together or florist or whatever. So it would be against their interest economically to break up.
Someone once commented to me that most of my best friends are all exes. And I was thinking about that, and I realized, well, if I'm going to spend so much time getting to know someone, why would I throw him off a roof?
Exactly. That's right. I talk about bad heterosexual values, and I think that that's a good case in point where they just throw somebody off the roof, and they don't keep in their lives this person that they know so well and that they've shared so much with.
Edmund White, you've also said in that Guardian article, the key to writing sex scenes is not to write pornographically, but to write faithfully, which is usually comic. That's one of the first times I've ever seen anybody actually come out and say that if you're in the middle of sex and you stop and look at what you're doing, it's really hard to get back into it because you're laughing so hard.
Yeah, and there's another aspect to it that's comic, which is Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, said that the basis of humor is when the body resists the spirit or the mechanical world doesn't conform to the psychological world. And I think that oftentimes, you know, like let's say two young lovers decide to run off forever and ever, and they rush out the door, but the door sticks and they can't get out. That would be a comic moment by Bergson's definition. It means slapstick, really, and a lot of silent movies use that kind of humor. I think he's right. It explains a lot of the humor of sex, is that we oftentimes wish we were more athletic, more romantic, better lovers than we can actually manage to be.
Well, how do you write a sex scene? Because you write a lot of them in your various books. How do you get away with it without either going, this is too funny or this is too pornographic? How do you maintain that?
Well, I think you have to make sure that the scenes are expressive of character. You know, that it's an action like any other action, like getting a new job or fighting with your child or whatever. Whatever the actions are in a book that express the character of the person you're writing about. And I think sex has to be that way, too, that it has to say something about what the person's like. I mean, like, for instance, Will, in my book, The Straight Guy, meets a sexy Italian woman called Pia, and you feel like he's sort of starved sexually, that he hasn't had enough adventure in his life, hasn't slept with enough different people, and that a sensualist like Pia is a real delight to him and a real new experience. And also he gets involved toward the end of the 70s with a couple who have orgies. And there, I think he's terrified of being touched by another man because he's unusually homophobic. But when he's assured that that won't happen, then he likes the whole idea of an orgy because he likes the availability of all these different women.
The Pia scene is direct. I mean, we see the sex happening in front of us as we read the book. But the orgy scene, you made the choice to have it a description that he's giving to Jack. So you have to make choices about which scenes are going to be graphic and which won't.
That's right. Well, I thought it was something that Jack would get off on and be interested in and would pump Will for details. And it was sort of part of their shared experience, that Will telling him about this orgy, because Jack has had plenty of experiences like that. I mean, he's one time he brought five boys back to his apartment, and they all had sex together, and he told Will about it. And so he says to Will, oh, I'm jealous because you're going to be having sex with all these people. And Will says, wait a minute, I'm just trying to catch up. You know, you've been doing this for years. People ask me sometimes whether I read my reviews or whether I listen to readers' comments. And I do. And I'm aware every time I write a sex scene that it's going to turn off an awful lot of women, especially because it's too raunchy for them. Although there are women who are just as horny as men are.
There's some kind of divide between what gay men experienced way back when and what straight men did. 25 partners for a straight man was a lot. Multiply that exponentially, you know, and it's a different world.
I once wrote that I'd had 3,500 partners in my life, and somebody said, how could that be? And I said, well, it's not even that much. And I had gay readers who said to me, well, that's not so much. You're kind of cute. I would think you would have had more sex. Because I was just talking about if you're living in New York for 20 years and you pick up three guys a week, which isn't very many, or go to the baths and have two or three tricks, that it adds up very quickly. That's the thing that many straight men envy about gay men, is that they feel that gay men have very willing and accessible partners who don't need much courtship and don't need to be told sweet nothings in order to put out, whereas straight men oftentimes feel that they have to go through an elaborate courtship in order to get laid for the night.
Edmund White, simultaneously with Jack Holmes and his friend, a book has come out called Sacred Monsters, published by a small press called Magnus Books, featuring critical essays on such people as William and Henry James, John Retchie, Tennessee Williams, several others. How did that book come about, and why was it published by a small press?
I don't think anybody wants to publish essays. They're not usually big sellers. The publisher was a friend of mine, Don Weissy, who used to work for Clayus Press in San Francisco, and he published an earlier book of my essays for Clayus called Arts and Letters. And then he was starting up this publisher. It's pretty much a one-man operation, and he wanted something by me. So I said, well, you can have these essays, and so he accepted them. And I think he did a very nice job. The cover is great, and it's a drawing by Rodin, which ties in with the opening essay of the book, which is about when I was a child and I was in love with Rodin's statue of the Belgian soldier. And this is a drawing of that same soldier. So I don't know. I mean, I just think that it isn't something that a major publisher would want to take on because there are very small sales for essays.
Well, where did the essays come from? New York Review of Books, places like that?
Mostly the New York Review of Books, yeah. I mean, the last 3 or 4 years I've written an awful lot for them. I mean, Bob Silvers seems to like my writing. He never asks you if you want to review something. He just sends you the book with a note asking you to review it. And so next thing you know, you're doing it. And I think he realizes that I would be interested in gay people and writers. So he sent me a biography of Cheever to review, which was great fun for me because I got to reread Cheever and talk about his whole career.
I don't read them because they would keep me from reading everything else, reading these reviews in New York Review books. They're not quite reviews. They're really essays which the book kind of threads its way in and out. On some level, I would guess that Sacred Monsters is, in its own weird way, an intellectual autobiography of you.
It does talk a lot about a lot of writers who have influenced me and maybe shaped my own sensibility, I hope. Some of them I wasn't able to collect, but like I did an essay on Malaparte, who's an Italian writer of the 30s and 40s, and I found him absolutely fascinating. And I love two of his books, Caput and The Skin, which were written during World War II. And he was a fascist and a friend of Mussolini's. That's why we probably don't know his name anymore, because it was a bad career choice to be a fascist. But his books are beautifully written. They're just amazing. And he had a fascinating life. And Caput is about the Eastern Front in the war, and he was a very close observer of what was going on. And he was a diplomat, and so he had access to the highest circles. After the Allies conquered Italy in 43, they took over Naples, and he attached himself to the American army and befriended them and helped them orient themselves. And he writes about that in The Skin, which is fascinating, too.
One thing about these essay collections is that if you read them, they lead you into places where otherwise you would never have been led. Edmund White, now that you've finished Jack Holmes and His Friend, you've already begun work on the Paris autobiography?
Yes, I'm about 100 pages into it. Uh-huh. I hope to finish it next fall.
I understand that you have some trepidation simply because the Parisians might be a little more upset than the Americans.
Well, I doubt if this would be published in France. I mean, Ivan Nabokov, who's a nephew of the great Nabokov, is my editor there. But I think he wouldn't risk publishing this there, though he's published all my other books.
And you've completely recovered from your stroke.
Well, my speech is still a little slushy. Maybe you can hear it. If I give a reading, I have a hard time saying all the words. Maybe my voice is a little flatter and there's less affect than I used to have. I mean, I sound like I'm dead sometimes. But I think there used to be a kind of excitement always bubbling in my voice, and now it doesn't seem to be there. I can walk, but after 10 blocks, I'm very tired.
But it hasn't affected your mind or your writing, so...
I hope not. I hope not. I sometimes think my thinking is a little more childish than it used to be, that I'm sort of happy to say banalities like, oh, it's warm today and things like that, which I never would have said before.
You've been listening to an interview with Edmund White, whose latest novel is Jack Holmes and His Friend, also out at the same time, a collection, Sacred Monsters. Why the title?
Well, in French, you say monster sacré for... people who are so famous that they're above criticism, you know, they're sort of like institutions in society. Like Frank Sinatra would be an example in our culture where it would be silly to say, well, nobody listens to Frank Sinatra anymore, or he's finished, or, you know, in other words, he's sort of above criticism. He's there to stay. And that's a sacred monster in French.
And that's published by Magnus Press.
That's right. I mean, I think it's a gay press that's named after Magnus Hirschfeld, who was the first German to campaign for gay rights.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.